The Big Journey from Creation to New Creation. This is a Bible teaching series that will take you all the way through the Bible, from the creation account in Genesis to John's vision of the new creation in the book of Revelation. This series is brought to you by creationtonewcreation.com. After their rescue from Egypt, God's people didn't go straight to the Promised Land. They went to Mount Sinai to meet with God. There, God made a covenant with them. That covenant was like a marriage. Through this covenant, God became their husband. Remember what we learnt in the very first session. The Bible story is, at its heart, a love story. The goal of all history is a marriage. That marriage relationship began back there in the wilderness of Sinai. What happened there on Mount Sinai was like a wedding. We read about it in Exodus chapter 24. Firstly, at their wedding ceremony, a man and a woman make vows to each other. In the same kind of way, God made vows to his people, and they made vows to him. Then, after the ceremony, there's a wedding reception. Similarly, Moses, Aaron, and two of his sons, and 70 elders who represented the whole nation, ate and drank in God's presence on Mount Sinai. Finally, after their wedding, a married couple sets up home together. In the same way, God, the husband of his people, made arrangements to live together with his bride, Israel. He was going to live among them, in a beautiful tent called the Tabernacle. In Exodus 25, verse 8, we read that God commanded Moses, "Let them make me a sanctuary, that I may dwell in their midst." Firstly, then, God and his people made vows to each other. This was the actual wedding ceremony. Exodus chapters 20 to 23 are the marriage vows themselves. These vows are supplemented and expanded by various other passages in Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. In these passages, God vowed to love and care for his people, defeat their enemies, lead them into his promised land, and bless them abundantly. On their part, Israel was to love, serve, and obey God. God's law showed them how they could do this. In addition, the law specified a variety of sacrifices that were to be offered. These sacrifices were ordained in order to deal with the people's sin and to enable the holy God to live among them. Mankind rebelled against God in the Garden of Eden, but now God had formed a new mankind, his people Israel. This new mankind promised to do what Adam failed to do, to obey God. In Exodus 24, we read that Moses came and told the people all the words of the Lord and all the laws. And all the people answered with one voice and said, "All the words that the Lord has spoken, we will do." Then a solemn ceremony followed. In modern-day weddings, the bride and groom exchange rings and sign the marriage register. But the wedding between God and Israel was sealed with blood. Animals were sacrificed, and Moses threw the blood from the slaughtered animals against the altar. Then he read the book of the covenant to the assembled multitude. This book presumably included most of Exodus chapters 20 to 23. After the people had again vowed to obey God, Moses splashed blood over the book and over the people. Why did Moses splash blood like this? The text doesn't say, but there are clues. Firstly, the blood was splashed on the altar and the people, as well as the book. The altar seems to represent God, and so splashing blood on both people and altar seems to symbolize that the people were now linked to God. They were now God's special people, a holy nation consecrated to God. Secondly, there may well be another level of meaning here. Covenants in Bible times would typically be ratified by sacrificing an animal. Blood represents life. And when blood is shed, it represents life being poured out and brought to an end in death. Perhaps the sacrificial blood symbolized this. The two covenant partners, God and Israel, were saying, in effect, "May I be like these slain animals if I should ever break this covenant." In other words, if either party ever broke the covenant, they, like the animals whose blood was shed, would have to die. We know, of course, that Israel and every individual Israelite did break the covenant, and so they should have suffered the death penalty. But instead, God accepted the death of sacrificed animals instead. We'll look at the sacrifices in our next talk. After every wedding ceremony, there is normally a wedding reception. After this wedding in the wilderness, too, there was a feast. Moses ascended Mount Sinai. He was accompanied by Aaron and two of his sons and 70 elders who represented the whole nation. There these men saw God. Under his feet was a pavement like sapphire, clear as the sky. Here was privilege indeed. God laid a banquet before them. They ate and drank in his presence. As we saw in a previous talk, if you ate with someone in those ancient times, it meant that you were in relationship with them. Douglas Stewart tells us, in the ancient world, and many places in the modern world, people would not eat together if they were not somehow allies or family. And thus, when people made a covenant with each other, they might celebrate their covenant relationship by eating together. In this case, only one party to the covenant ate and drank, Moses and the Israelites with him. But the link between eating and fellowship seems certain to apply here too. In Bernard Bell's words, the meal that they enjoyed was a fellowship meal in God's presence, a meal which sealed the covenant in an even more profound way than did the blood thrown upon the altar and upon the people. Through the blood ceremony and the meal eaten in his presence, God became Israel's husband. Israel became God's bride. Finally, after all the wedding celebrations, a married couple set up home together. So God made plans to come and live among his people. God told Moses to make a tent where he, the holy God, could live among his people. God gave him the plans which we find detailed in the later chapters of Exodus. God was going to live in a tent, just like his people did, and he was going to pitch his tent right in the center of their camp, as close to them as he could possibly get. So God called a man called Bezalel. God filled him with his spirit, giving him ability and intelligence, with knowledge and all craftsmanship. God appointed Aholiab to help Bezalel. These two men, assisted by others, were to make the tabernacle and all its furniture, the priest's clothes, the anointing oil, and the incense. When all was ready, the tabernacle was erected, and God moved into his new home. Then the cloud covered the tent of meeting, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. And Moses was not able to enter the tent of meeting because the cloud settled on it, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. What was the tabernacle like? Well, imagine that you yourself were there in the camp of Israel in the Sinai wilderness. The tabernacle is right in the center of the camp. Imagine that you're in the camp of Israel and you're approaching the tabernacle. All you can see as you approach is a high linen screen surrounding an enclosure around 150 by 75 feet. Inside this screened-off area is a large tent. You can just see the very top of this tent above the screen. The entrance to the screened enclosure is on its eastern side. That's significant, as we will see. The entrance is an opening in the linen screen, in front of which is a multicoloured hanging. Skirting round this hanging, you find yourself in the courtyard. In the courtyard, as well as the tent, there's an altar and a large basin. The altar is immediately in front of you as you enter the courtyard. You'll probably see animal sacrifices burning on it. Walking past the altar towards the tent, you pass the basin. Perhaps you'll see priests washing there. Continuing past the basin, you arrive at the entrance of the tabernacle tent itself. It's quite a large tent, about 15 feet high, 15 feet wide, and 45 feet long. It doesn't look much from outside. Its outer covering is made of animal skins, But there's a beautiful embroidered hanging at the entrance, made of blue and purple and scarlet yarn and fine linen. Pushing through this hanging, you find yourself in the front compartment of a tent. This compartment is called the Holy Place. Only the priests could enter here, so you'll have to imagine that you're one of the priests. The sides of the tent are supported by wooden frames, overlaid with gold and set in silver sockets. Over these frames is draped a beautiful innermost covering. It's made of fine linen, blue, purple, and scarlet yarns, and decorated with cherubim. Over this innermost covering is a number of outer protective coverings, but you can't see these, of course, from inside. To your left, you'll see a golden seven-branched candlestick, its seven flickering flames of a tense source of light. On your right is a table overlaid with gold. On it are 12 loaves of bread. On it, too, are vessels that include bowls and flagons for the drink offering presumably being of wine. This is God's table. On it is bread, and it seems likely wine as well. The priests ate this bread week by week. Remember how Moses and the others with him ate and drank in God's presence on Mount Sinai? That was a meal that celebrated fellowship with God. The bread on this table is also a meal eaten in God's presence. This meal in the tabernacle is also a token of fellowship between God and his people, represented by the priests. In front of you is an altar. It's overlaid with gold. Incense is burning on it. A wonderful fragrance fills the room. The light from a lampstand illuminates the gorgeous multicoloured curtains and reflects off the gold and silver all around the holy place. The beauty and splendour of this holy room would have taken your breath away. Behind the incense altar, you see a veil. Like the innermost covering of the tent, this veil is made of fine linen, blue, purple, and scarlet yarns, and decorated with cherubim. Beyond this veil is the most holy place. You dare not enter here. Only the high priest, once a year, may enter this holiest of rooms. It contains just one piece of furniture, the Ark of the Covenant. This is an acacia wood box overlaid with gold. On this box is a slab of pure gold, the mercy seat or atonement cover. The most holy place was where God himself was present. It was his throne room. The mercy seat was his footstool. On either end of the mercy seat was a golden cherub. These two cherubim stretched their wings over the mercy seat. God was enthroned on these cherubim. From this holy place, God reigned over his people and over the whole earth. God is holy. Remember how the Apostle John saw a vision of God sitting on his throne in heaven. The four living creatures around his throne called out ceaselessly, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord God Almighty, who was and is to come." But how could the holy God possibly come to live here in a world contaminated with sin? God's solution was this tabernacle. It was his spotlessly holy sanctuary in the midst of a fallen world. Viewed from outside, all you would see would be the dark outermost covering of leather, rather dull and ordinary. But stepping inside was like stepping into a different world, a world of beauty and fragrance. That was the whole point. It was a different world. It was a place where God lived and ruled a meticulously crafted world of holiness and glory and peace. The tabernacle wasn't God's first home on earth. You'll remember that he first walked on earth in the Garden of Eden. The tabernacle was, so to speak, a new Garden of Eden, where God once again lived on earth among mankind. And so, as we might expect, there are links between the tabernacle and the garden. Firstly, God put Adam in the Garden of Eden to work it and keep it. The word keep can also be translated guard. Though these words are used in other ways, it's interesting that both terms occur together in the book of Numbers to describe the work of the priests and Levites in the tabernacle. That's our first link. Secondly, God expelled mankind from the garden eastwards. We assume this because God placed cherubim to guard the way to the tree of life at the east of the garden. Anyone seeking access to the tree of life, had that been permitted, would have had to enter the garden on its eastern side and travel westwards into the midst of the garden. The entrance to the tabernacle, like the garden, was on its eastern side. People seeking access to God's presence in the most holy place, had that been freely permitted, would have had to enter the tabernacle courtyard on its eastern side and travel westwards towards the presence of God in the most holy place. So people entering the tabernacle were retracing, as it were, the way back to God's presence and blessing. Thirdly, the way to the tree of life in the Garden of Eden was protected by cherubim. Accordingly, we find cherubim in the tabernacle too. Its innermost covering was decorated with them, and two cherubim watched over the mercy seat in the most holy place. Fourthly and finally, in the midst of the garden was the tree of life. There was a symbolic tree of life in the tabernacle too. The candlestick in the holy place was like a tree, with its branches and with cups shaped like almond flowers. But the tabernacle didn't just look back to the Garden of Eden, it looked forward too. It was a step towards the glorious new world to be unveiled at the end of this age. Remember what happened when the tabernacle was complete. The glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. This was nothing less than a preview of the day when the glory of God will one day fill the whole earth. God often called his tabernacle the tent of meeting. In fact, he said to Moses, "The entrance of the tent of meeting, there I will meet with the people of Israel." God, as far as was possible under that covenant, welcomed people into his home. He wanted to be as close as possible to his people and to have fellowship with them. Only certain people could come into the tabernacle, and then only under certain strict conditions, but they could come. God chose Aaron and his sons to minister as priests in the tabernacle. They were robed in special garments. They were to keep the tabernacle holy and to serve him there. A key part of their work was to offer sacrifices. They also taught people the law, acted as judges, and dealt with cases of leprous diseases. The priests mediated between God and his people. They worshipped and served God on behalf of the whole nation, and they administered God's rule and blessing to the nation. But the whole nation was called to be priests too. They were a kingdom of priests. They were all to worship and serve God, and keep the camp of Israel, and later the promised land, holy. Earlier we learnt about the marriage vows between God and his people. These vows were supplemented and expanded by various other passages in Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. Collectively, we call these passages the Law. In our next talk, we'll look at the law that God gave his people and the sacrifices that they were to offer him. We'll also look at God's calendar of holy days and festivals that he set in place for his people.